Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello, we're starting the new year with a mystery. Susie's picking another oracle card. So let's see what we have to start this technical new year rather than actual new year. But it's psychological. It's the story of the new year.
It's the story of the new year in our culture.
Yeah.
So this deck rather beautifully speaks to what we were speaking about last time about people being famous or not, or acknowledged or not. And it's funny, for me, I know exactly where this deck comes from and who it's by. Except that I realised, as I pulled a card this morning for this, that actually, I've got no idea who it's by. Because although I bought it at the end of an absolutely exquisite evening of Sufi music and prayers, where there was the remembered recitation, not the reading, of some Rumi and beautiful songs and music, and there were two women and it was all very wonderful. And I know that these are a deck made by the one who was doing the recitations. And I've realised by looking at this deck, nowhere does it say who she is. So I have no idea whose deck this is, but it's beautiful and it's got the original Persian and her English translations on it. And it's on the back is a picture of, I'm assuming it's him.
Rumi?
Yeah.
Hmm? Possibly. Nobody knows what Rumi
Nobody
looked
knows.
Like.
Okay. Well, anyway. So there we are.
How lovely. What a gift.
I know.
And she's actually saying, these go out. Yes, pay me money for them. That's absolutely fine. But I don't need the credit. Wow.
Yeah. Love it.
That's an advance song.
It is. Yeah. And also, I suppose, in a way, how could you put your name on them? Because these are all Rumi's words.
Well, that's true, but I love the Hafiz translations by Daniel Ladinsky. And it's important that Daniel Ladinsky puts his name to them, because a lot of people disagree with his translations of Rumi. Of Hafiz. So it's actually his projection onto Hafiz, because he updates him and uses words that we would use in our modern time, which make Hafiz's poems absolutely relevant for now. I think that's beautiful, but in his case, I think it's important that he puts his name there so that people know that this is an updated interpretation.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. Okay.
What have you got anyway?
So anyway, I have drum sound rises on the air. It's throb, my heart. A voice inside the beat says, I know you are tired, but come, this is the way. And I just thought,
oh, wow. Oh, yes. This is Lectio Divina.
Okay, what does that mean?
It's when you study a sacred text and you just allow the words to permeate you. And you pull out whatever word or phrase really resonates and just sit with it. You know, that drumbeat of your heart. And it takes me back to so many times when my heart has vibrated to a sound. And sometimes it was a rock concert. And sometimes it is a drum. Sometimes it's the call of an animal. But those times when you feel your heart move and expand or contract or dance.
Yeah.
With whatever is being presented.
Yeah, beautiful. For me, it very much speaks to the story that I always tell when I'm helping people to create their own drum, that there are stories from all over the world which amount to the drum carries the heartbeat of the earth, and that when we play a drum, we are making manifest that the kind of acknowledgement of the aliveness of all of life, if you like, and the sacredness implicit in all of life by beating the drum. And that also, as somebody who makes the majority of her drums from the deer hide, is that interestingly, there are stories from, again, from all over the world that say that there is this very ancient sacred contract between humanity and the members of the deer family that say that they want their hides to have the honour of carrying the heartbeat of the earth.
Oh,
and isn't that beautiful?
Isn't
and that's
that?
A story that's told by all sorts of different peoples around the world, is that this is a sacred contract and that the deer people are honoured to carry.
Wow. I'm going to lower the tone immediately. So you do know that all Santa's reindeer are famous, are female, don't you?
Of course.
No such thing as Rudolph.
No, well, Rudolph could be a girl's name.
I guess it could, yes. Put me probably in my place with that one. So apparently only female reindeer have rain antlers in the winter.
Yeah, but yeah, because the males shed theirs following the rut.
Yeah.
I know, it's interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting. But I love that the deer is honoured by becoming part of the heartbeat. But that's exactly how it's meant to be, is that we are working in harmony with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I want to be buried when I die, to give something back.
Well, yes.
They better take the mercury out. I've still got some mercury in my teeth.
God. Yes, that's going to be interesting.
But I was always terrified when I was younger, so frightened of death, my astrology and all sorts of other weird stuff. And the thought of being incarcerated in a coffin stuck under the ground, thinking I'd still be there, you know, and always finding stories about people who scratched on the coffin.
Oh, I know.
But I want to give a gift back. Even if it's only my rotten old mouldering body.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, absolutely. Ecologically, that is the only way to go, basically, as we can no longer be excarnated, which would probably be my favourite way. apparently being blasted in a, whatever you call them, what do you call
cremator?
Being cremated is so wholly unecological. It takes so much power.
And also quite a lot of the crematoria now have to have filters because of the mercury, which is going up into the atmosphere, and that's why it's in the seas.
No way. Yes. Really?
Yeah. So they have to have certain... And our ridiculousness, because I did a fair amount of work about crematoria when I was in at seminary before ordination. I went and worked downstairs in a crematorium for a week and so I could get over the fear of death and all that. And some of them have to have filters. And Golders Green Crematorium is a Grade One listed building. It's a rather beautiful building. They also have a chapel for children.
Oh, heartbreak.
It is heartbreaking. A tiny little place. It is heartbreaking. But the ridiculousness of it is that nowadays people are much bigger and fatter than they used to be. So they can't use 50% of their cremators. And they've had to build new ones, which were allowed. But they're not allowed to take down the old ones, which are absolutely unusable, because it's a Grade One listed building. We are daft, aren't we? I don't know what the point of that was, but we are daft.
Wow. There's something really rather horrible about that.
To
imagine that we're getting so plump as a rule, even, that we don't fit in there. But then I suppose also it's not necessarily just about plumpness, isn't it? I mean, I don't know how old the building is or how old the cremators are, but we're also lucky, us in the West, pretty well fed, although by the time this is out, maybe we won't be so well fed. Because, apparently we've got food shortages and stuff to look forward to and the chaos
quite possibly. But actually, this all brings me around to what I wanted to mention, something that you highlighted last time, but we didn't have time to follow up on, which is coming back to the what is mine to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've found that so useful over the years, learning what is mine to do and what isn't mine to do, and saying, show me what is mine to do. Because as soon as you said about helping people make their own drums, the old-fashioned guilt came up and said, I didn't make my own drum. I bought one in Brussels. I bought one in an American shop in Brussels. I should make my own drum. And it just cut into, that's not your job.
No.
You have other work to do, which is of equal value of making your own drum. It's all right to buy a drum. And I think so much of our lives are the shoulds.
That's one of the things that I think possibly social media is... exerting an influence which is perhaps not acknowledged, which is that that now we have access to the creativity of so many other people. That I think one of the new sticks that we beat ourselves with in the in 2021, as it will be when this is heard, is oh, you know, I should be not only doing all the things that I do, but maybe I should also be, I don't know, my personal stick. The reason why I'm talking this was I've made acorn flour this year, and I haven't made acorn flour since I was a kid, I don't think. But along with all the other kinds of harvesting and storing and foraging and all the rest of it. And frankly, it was a step too far. And I didn't really have time. I desperately wanted more acorn biscuits. I was given some acorn flour and I made acorn biscuits and they're bloody delicious. But for every step of making that acorn flour, really, I knew that I was doing something that was a step too far. And in, but in a way, in my own parlance, I was doing the equivalent of fracking myself, because there was, this was energy that wasn't available for use, really. I didn't, you know.
Oh, that's a really good analogy. Fracking yourself.
Well, that's what it is, isn't it? It's taking from the earth what she's not freely giving.
Yeah.
And I was doing that to me, you know. I was taking from myself energy and time and all the rest of it. Not, you know, a bit of it was because I wanted to have acorn biscuits, but too much of it was because I wanted to have, like, ticked the box that said, yes, I made acorn flour too this year. I'm a good forager. And it was a step too far.
Yes. I had exactly the same with sourdough. You know, everybody on social media was posting pictures of their wonderful sourdough. Well, I made my sourdough starter with kefir and I was jolly chuffed with it and it started rising. I made the most awful loaves.
Oh, no.
They were I am not a natural bread maker. I'd known this before, but I did exactly the same. I kept trying. And then I just gave up and went down to Farmer Luxton's, which is the butcher and general shop on the way into Oakhampton from us, and they're lovely people there. They're always kind. They give me free bones for the dogs. You're allowed to take your dogs in, and we're socialising new dogs.
That's just
at
the cruel.
Well, yes, that's true. But they sell this really beautiful sourdough made by somebody in Cornwall. So why on earth am I fracking myself?
Yeah.
When I can prosper somebody who's doing it properly and have a jolly good discussion. And if I didn't go in there quite often, I wouldn't have got to know the staff there. And therefore, when our friend Adam came to stay when he was ill last year, and he wanted to say thank you by giving us half a sheep.
Good grief.
He was taking half a sheep home. And because I went in with him and Stuart was talking to us and Adam was showing such interest in the sheep, he said, well, would you like to come and see me cut it up? And Adam was so thrilled.
Wow.
So from being a dismal failure at making sourdough, you move into allowing somebody else to do the job, making friendships and prosperity moving on from that.
Absolutely. Do you know what? We were talking about that this very morning. Fergus makes great sourdough, actually. But
My
bread making over the years has been varied. I mean, I am entirely able to make really good bread, but it doesn't seem to be a regular thing. But anyway, personally, what it boils down to is absolutely can't be bothered to make bread, because the best bread ever arrives in a little yellow van in Moreton Hampstead twice a week, the Vin du Pain, where the lovely Liz and Laurent make fantastic bread, wonderful pastries and, you know, yummy, like croissant and what are those things called that aren't a baton? You know, what's a French stick called?
I don't know, French loaves, French stick? No. The long, thin ones.
Yes.
The long, thin ones. You know what we're talking about.
On any other day of the year, I would remember what it was called. That's hilarious. Baguette.
Thank you.
So they make such wonderful bread. Anyway, three different kinds of lovely, lovely, just ordinary sourdough loaves and blah, blah. I could wax lyrical for ages. But anyway, part of Moreton Hampstead's enthusiastic reception of this insanely delicious bread and pastries has meant that when our hospital closed in Moreton, now there's a community kitchen in the hospital's kitchen, and that community kitchen, as well as housing Liz with her bread and Laurent with his cakes, also has the capacity to, for example, support the Syrian refugees who live in Moreton Hampstead to create wonderful Syrian feasts, which raise money to be able to support that woman, as I understand it, to create a like a kind of, you know, you can ring up a takeaway Syrian style kind of feast every now and then, and the using of the leftover bananas from the co-op or whatever when they're out of date or they're going brown in the baking of bread, which then goes back to funding the kitchen to provide food for those who need it. Yeah. And you can see how that prosperity, us all going, oh my God, that's so much better bread than I can make. That's the best sourdough in the world ever. I'm going to buy that has had all these extraordinary offshoots for our community, which are so beautiful and nourishing to people's lives. And that if we'd all kind of, you know, stayed home and stuck with the sourdough. I mean, there's another part of me that goes, staying home and making your own sourdough is wonderful because then you really understand what it is to make bread and where it comes from and why it should never be wasted and all that. But on the other hand, when you go and buy it from the Van du Pain, you're supporting so much else. And that's one of the kind of tricks of our society, which I think is so insanely hard to get right, is the balance between I should be doing it for me because then I understand what it's worth and I don't contribute to the endless cycle of purchasing that's out there. And yet also there's such a case to be made in some places for going and joining in with the purchasing because of what else it supports.
Yes. I make a very nice buckwheat and spelt flatbread, which I fry, and it's lovely. So I can make that. If I need bread to make at home, I'll make that. I've also got a bread maker. And every now and then I make a lovely fruit loaf or a loaf in that if I've got people coming around, because they get beautiful fresh bread. And part of me thinks, oh, I should have made it myself. Another part of me says, no, I'm going to give my time for something else today.
Yeah.
That is what is mine to do.
Yeah.
And we get the house pervading with the gorgeous scent of baking bread while I am doing the research to help that person in another way. Mm. So there is this trap of we think we have to be everything to everybody, and that's the superwoman type thing, I think,
for
women particularly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we don't. And my sister-in-law gave up work when she was pregnant with her twins and never went back to work. She's volunteered in many places. She's learnt different languages. She's kept her brain very thing, but she raised two wonderful men because she taught them to cook. She taught them the things that my mother taught me. And there is a lot to be said for a mother who will stay home and mother. But now we have to be superwoman, and now we need the money. We go out and we do lose this ability to learn what we are good at as children. Do you know what I mean? Because we have to do everything at school now. You have to follow the curriculum. But there are some things that I had to learn ballet for 3 years. I was dreadful. I was utter crap. And then I went on and learned the piano because you had to have something extra, extracurricular to show that you were, I don't know whether it was to show you could afford it for your children or whether it was ego for your children or whatever. And then I was so bad at piano, I did 3 years and never got to grade one.
Whoa! Didn't practice, did you, Maggie?
No, I didn't practice. Because I didn't care.
Yeah, you didn't
I was
like
reading
it,
books about ponies because I wanted to ride ponies and I wanted to go and work at a riding stables on Saturday mornings. That's how I wanted to do my extracurricular. I wanted to lean my head into the side of a warm, living, breathing creature and brush it and clean its hooves up and pick up its shit.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I wanted to do. So after that, they put me in the brownies, which was, you know, it was just the way the story went at that particular school. And I was so bad at the brownies. I always tell people I was expelled for cheating on my housework badge, but actually I got away with that. I was kicked out because I never showed up. But I did cheat on my housework badge.
How on earth do you cheat on a brownie badge?
I put in a duster that my mother had darned, not me.
Maggie Whitehouse.
I wasn't cut out to be a brownie mum, really. I wasn't.
No, I had the reverse, actually. I wanted desperately to be in a brownies because the other solitary other little girlfriend that I had was in the brownies. But, yeah, for some reason, I wasn't allowed to go to brownies. I must ask my mum one day, why was I not allowed to go to brownies?
Why were you?
No, but it might be that my school went on so late that maybe brownies began before I ended school or something.
Entirely possible.
Very strange.
But I went into brownies and had to sing every week the song, "This is what we do as elves, think of others, not ourselves," which for a little baby codependent was not helpful. Because yes, you must think of others, but you also have to balance yourself. Think of yourself and work out what it is you need.
Definitely.
Otherwise you're giving from an empty cup.
Yeah.
Yep, 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 yep. Good old Jesus, wash the inside of the inside of the cup, not the outside that matters. What's in the inside? What's in you?
Yeah.
Than what you're dressed up as.
Uh-huh. Yes, indeed. What is in your cup is far more significant than what your cup is.
Yes. And of course that neatly gets lost with the search for the Holy Grail, which in most places, Indiana Jones got it right in that the Grail would have been an ordinary shepherd's cup. It would not have been gold or anything like that. And anyway, the other thing about that is nobody knew at the time it was the Last Supper and they had to keep it.
Yeah. Well, and also, weren't they in an inn? So it wouldn't have belonged to them anyway.
No, it wouldn't. No, they were in a Casaluma, an upper room, whether it's a private house or an inn, I don't know.
That's so funny. Yeah. But yes. Yes, but something, oh dear, what was that about cups? Something really started to kind of sprout in me by way of, ooh, that's so interesting, and now it's gone, never mind, eh?
Yeah. Well, when I started doing communion, I bought myself a little wooden cup. And I was actually got told by the powers that be that we don't use communion cups like that, so I got myself a gold-coloured one. But nowadays, I think, I wish I hadn't got rid of that. I wish I'd kept that. I wish I got tied up in somebody else's story. And then I realised, well, no, why would a communion cup be posh?
Yeah. I have to admit, I'm very surprised. I would have thought a tin mug would do.
I once did communion. I always do communion on transatlantic flights.
Really?
Yeah. Imaginary fire, but I was asked for wine and bread.
On a transatlantic flight? Yeah. You're kidding.
I'm not. I
do
don't
you
know
tell
why.
Me? Come on, I really, my, this is hilarious. If I found somebody, what do? Do you stand up and say, I want to offer communion?
No, I just do it quietly by myself.
Oh, I see, okay.
Oh, no, I just say, all of you shall get around and we will, no. Oh, God, that must go in a book one day. That would be hysterical,
wouldn't it? It would be so funny.
But the interesting
thing. And you'd probably be banned.
what was interesting, once we went to Japan, a huge long flight, and it was one of those really odd things in that we were in an almost empty aircraft. It was very, very, very light. And I thought, I'm going to do communion. So I asked the staff if I could have some wine and some bread. And some water. And I told them why. And four of them came and sat with me.
Ah, cute.
They'd never, ever been to a Church of England communion or a Catholic communion in their lives. They were really interested about somebody who wanted to do that on their flight. So we just did this little slow service and they had the bread and the wine, and I don't know whether they got anything out of it, but I suppose they'll remember it.
Yeah, that's really cute.
Yeah. Well, it goes along the lines of my bishop telling me that you always wear your dog collar in a hospital or on a long distance flight. In
so
the hospital, so
you
can get
are.
Where you need to go, and on the flight, if it goes down, they know who to blame. I love that one.
Classic. Aww.
But actually, it is so, because if you are wearing your dog collar and somebody's in desperate trouble on a flight, they will call for a doctor, but they might also call for a priest.
Right.
You don't know.
That's... Oh dear, yes, sorry. In my head there is still this little film playing of Maggie just stands up and to the entire plane, starts offering communion, whether you like it or not.
We'll have confession first.
Oh lordy.
Wafting down saying, what would you like to confess before we do communion?
Can you imagine? That would surely, do you do confession?
Not in so many words, but people do tell me things.
Yeah.
And usually it's funny, people want permission to do things when they come and have astrology readings. Quite often they come and ask permission. They don't need permission, but it's helpful that we can give them permission from the planets, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So say, this is lined up for you, this appears to be a good time, or no.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think people love to have their sacredness honoured.
Yeah. I was really blown away by, at the time of the conjunction, how many national newspapers were running a story that basically amounted, you know, quite a big story, basically amounted to, hey, we're moving into the time of Aquarius.
Yeah.
We've all got permission to be more sacred now.
Yeah.
And it felt like a sort of strange self-fulfilling prophecy, that there it was, the astrology saying we are moving into more sacred times, if you like.
Potentially sacred times. Yes.
Not that the times are more sacred, but that we're going to be more willing to speak about the sacredness of the times.
Yes.
And there they were already speaking about the sacredness of the times.
Yes.
It really struck me.
And the fact that it was called the Star of Bethlehem, and people needed that hope at the end of last year.
Yeah.
We always need hope. We do need the signs and the portents and the prophets.
Yeah. And the permission to change the story.
Yes.
You know.
Or to revert to the original story, because basically it always is the original perennial wisdom that we come back to.
Yeah.
Florence Scovel Shinn, who wrote the wonderful book The Game of Life and How to Play It, and several other books, and they're very small books, which is helpful,
mm-hmm.
because you can just read them through. And she says, nearly all the really great movies have a mystical heart. And think about it, It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, that's such a lovely film. Yeah.
It is. And The Lord of the Rings.
Okay. As an aficionado of big dress dramas, where's the sacred heart of Sense and Sensibility? Shameful admission from the witch. Yes, I'm afraid so. I love big dress dramas.
Oh, I like them too. No, I'm thinking about movies that... Sense and Sensibility was utterly brilliant. And the TV series was really good as well. And I adore that book. But I wouldn't call that one of the great movies.
No, fair enough.
It doesn't turn up every year at Christmas or something.
That's very
like
true.
That.
No.
And you can make a great movie without the sacred. But I think that was a comedy of manners, and it was a really useful example, certainly for me, about the difference between Marianne and Eleanor. And what it taught me was that those who do not speak of their grief don't still feel it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because you don't say anything. And I used to find that a lot. People always used to say to me after Henry died, you'll be fine, you're a strong woman. That used to annoy the hell out of me.
I bet.
But presumably it was because I didn't show that much weepy, howly, waily emotion. Didn't mean I didn't feel it.
Yeah.
And Sense of Sensibility really taught me that about Eleanor. So there's something in there, but I don't know if it's sacred.
No.
Well, everything's sacred.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And yes, you're right, though, that those are... Well, that's interesting. If great films have the sacred in their heart, do great books? Because I would say that those are great books.
Jane Austen?
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. Because in all her books, it works out okay.
Mm.
There's a lovely old saying that says, if the ending isn't happy, it isn't the ending.
Yeah. And which takes us back to that thing we were saying of, oh my God, my brain is completely gone. That's hilarious. Of, what were we saying? Oh, Maggie, I'm quite tired.
Oh, honey. Well, that's just... It's not the ending, because it's not happy yet.
of our creation of our stories of what does everything mean is that's a kind of that amounts to that, really, is that if you are a person who is positive, you will always think that the story's not done, because you're not dead yet and you haven't found the happy bit yet. Whereas if you're the kind of person whose story is that it's all gone to shit and it's all you know, hell on earth, blah, 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 mm-hmm. then you will constantly be in that. And when you have happy times, they'll be the blips rather than the baseline.
Yeah. I had a revelation. It's sort of relevant, but if I may, it's just sort of come up. So I had a revelation over the Christmas period time, the resting time. Oh, so valuable. And I was, what I do as meditation as a Kabbalist, sometimes I'll go up into what I know I call the upper room, which is where this school of the soul lives, if you see what I mean, the incarnate and the discarnate. So you go up there to talk with the divine in your own particular language, if you see what I mean. And I went up there. Our teacher died last year, the primary teacher of the school that I have developed in my own way. And I went up to the upper room and he was there.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned around and said, oh, there you are. And so immediately, being me, I went, oh, God, I'm late. But actually, so I said to him, I am teaching on. And I am adapting and changing a lot. I'm taking a lot of the feminine. He said, yes, I know. And he said, and you're ready to do that because you forgave me. And I looked at it. And we did have a really, really big quarrel a long time ago.
Oh.
And I said, well, yes, I did. Of course I forgave you. But I never forgave Harold. That was another of their protagonists. And he said, you weren't here to forgive Harold. You were here this lifetime to learn to forgive me. And that was what it was all about. And I thought, and it just, something came in. And I thought, it wasn't that I was stupid. It wasn't that I forgot something. It was meant to be. All of this was meant to be for a purpose for me to learn from. And that was actually, it may sound like really nothing because it's quite obvious. But for that actual point, I thought, I don't have to forgive Harold. That's not my job.
Wow.
But I've done what I came to do and therefore I can move on to the next stage. And that was mine to do. It was not mine to deal with the periphery around it. It was mine to have a serious quarrel with my teacher and to get ill and to get better and to recover. And it was all meant to happen.
Right.
So I don't have to go, what did I do wrong? What was wrong? What was this? What was that? It was all part of my karma, if you like.
So what's the balance for you between meant to be and free will?
That's such a good question. And that's what it's really brought up for me.
Right.
The situation was meant to be, but I could have kept on carrying the wound.
Yeah. So you have the free will always to carry the wound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or to turn away. But I had got the, even though I got the free will, I got the wiring to be able to look at it differently, which is the same wiring as why I didn't reject Christianity. Well, I did reject Christianity, but I didn't throw it out of the window forever. I got, what's going on here? What's going on here? What's going on here? And I did that also with the quarrel with my teacher. What's going on here? What was my responsibility? What actually? And it was very valuable because he wasn't a dark teacher at all, but one of the things he taught us was you have to meet a dark teacher.
Explain a dark teacher.
Somebody who's going to mess you up.
Oh, God.
Or somebody who's going to appear to be a very bright teacher but then suddenly turns into your nemesis or something like that, or turns out to be corrupt or something. My first ever teacher, when I joined the National Federation of Spiritual Healers, as a probationer, you had to have a supervisor. And my supervisor seemed to be a very wise, wonderful woman until the day she started telling us she was the Virgin Mary and we were all the disciples reincarnated.
Oh.
You know, at which point you go, oh. Some of the others didn't go, oh. Some of the others went, oh, I knew it! But I went, oh.
Because, later, love.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because if I am, I really have forgotten an awful lot and need to go over some rehearsals here.
Yeah, but luckily, yes, we're back to, and you have the grace to just go, okay, that's your reality, and I'll go over here with mine.
Yeah.
You don't need to make her wrong, you don't need to change her.
No, because she did amazing work with a lot of people from that belief.
Mm.
And she was certainly part of the starting of my going, well, could that be? Could she be? Could that, would, why would she, why? What?
Yeah.
What's going on here? How do I find out more about this? What do we know?
Yeah, fair.
Yeah, that was mine too.
I've had my dark teacher.
You have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was it valuable?
So valuable. So many lessons.
Yeah.
Not the least is that it is a, you know, if not daily, at least weekly prayer along the lines of, please don't ever let me get a promo story that I then believe.
A promo story?
Yeah, it's a thing I've seen too many times in the world now, is that you get people who are, they've got something to say, they're great teachers, they're absolutely authentically coming from a beautiful place of, this is mine to do. And then at some point, the kind of, the story of how I came to be becomes kind of codified, if you like. And somewhere in it, there'll be this bit that's not quite true,
mm-hmm.
but they've just made it, you know, they've made their Celtic grandmother a druid or whatever to
make the story better.
To make the story better, yeah. Yes. And then they start to believe the hype.
Yes.
About themselves.
Yes.
And they basically become a total twat.
Yes.
And it's like, yes! Please don't ever let that happen to me. Please, please, pretty please. Just, you know.
Yeah. And then that's what happened to David Icke.
Really?
I think so, because his first books were brilliant. And then I saw him on the Wogan show where everybody laughed at him. And he had come on looked like a twat, wearing a turquoise tracksuit and telling everybody that they were Christ, which, of course, everybody is. But it's not the place to tell people on national TV at 7 p.m.
With Terry Wogan.
Not really. And I think from then on, the story of the rejection, perhaps, I don't know, I don't follow David Icke, but you can see it in the pattern of so many people that you come up and try and shine too soon and get swatted. And you either learn from that or you go into the dark side, if you like.
Well, I don't know, the thing I'm talking about is when Fergus has had, as long as I've known him, he's had this great expression, follow the light and not the lantern. And that I've seen too many teachers come up,
yes,
really bearing the light, you know, yes, bringing the wisdom, the information, yes, the shining the bloody torch on the page so we can read what's
yeah
written, whether it's in the river, in the leaves, in the wind, in the whatever, you know, mixing the metaphors horribly. And as soon as they imagine that as a lantern they are in some way important, that's it, they're fucked.
Yes.
Excuse them.
Yes, no, that summed it up beautifully. It's back to the old worshipping the signpost rather than following the route, isn't it?
Totally, yeah.
I'm the light, you've got to worship me, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that Warren always did, which was wise, this is the teacher, was he said if he ever saw anybody even trying to put him on a pedestal, he would jump right off it in front of them.
Yeah.
And show them where he could be an absolute twat.
Yes. Well, I mean, no offence, but I feel confident that you and I perform this very on a weekly basis and aren't in much danger of being pedestalised.
Oh, no, I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Cool. On that score, I believe we are at
37 minutes.
Oh, it's nearly 38.
So it is. Another 5 seconds will make it to 38. Thank you for joining us this new year. We'll be back next week with more
Witcherings.
Witcherings and bickerings. God bless.
Bye.